based on the book The Prophetic Imagination by Walter Brueggemann. And last week, we really kind of unpacked what was happening in the series, what this series is going to be about. And it's really about using our imagination for our time, opening our hearts and our minds to God's imagination for us, and to be inspired by the Spirit, discover how we can use our imagination to see through systems that are in place in our society that keep us divided, that set up these systems of privilege and power, and how we can have a raise of consciousness so that we can live God's dream for us. So last week we began by remembering the story of the Exodus, when the Israelite people were enslaved in Egypt. And we remember the story of Moses, who led the Israelites out of slavery into freedom. The challenge was, in this system, in this imperial system that was set up by the Pharaoh, it wasn't just the Israelite slaves who were suffering under this slave system, but by the plagues and by killing the firstborn of the Egyptian families, even those who were living in comfort and security were hurt, were suffering by these systems that were in place. So this morning we're going to continue on in this story. We remember that when the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness, they were still wanting to go back to the comfort of Egypt because they didn't want to just continue to eat manna in the wilderness, but they survived. They made it to Judah and they settled in the land. When the people had settled, they settled in what is now modern-day Israel and Palestine. And at this time, the people were living as a tribal culture. And there were judges who were the leaders of the local tribes. Does anyone know what a judge was at this time in Israel's history? Does anybody know who a judge was or what a judge would do? It's very different. I mean, we're not talking about Judge Judy, right? So does anyone know the role of a judge? This is not something that we often talk about, right? So judges were leaders. They were tribal leaders. They were more like warrior leaders. So I'm going to open this. But one of my favorite stories of the judges was of a woman named Deborah, who was ruthless. But here's this woman who is a leader of her people. She's a warrior leader. She is a conqueror, but she's also a protector of her people. She's also the person who's going to establish justice amongst her tribe. If you read in Judges 4 and chapter 4 and chapter 5, you can read about Deborah. But what's interesting to me about this is that it's not just men who are leaders, who are warriors at this time. Have you ever seen the movie Braveheart about William Wallace? That's what you want to think about when you're thinking about these judges. So people are living like this for some time, and then the people begin to think, we want a king. Wouldn't it be great if we could be united, we could have a king? And so they did. And Saul was the first king of Israel, followed by King David, who is the most famous of all of the kings. And then Solomon becomes king. Solomon is David's son. And the interesting thing about this story, do you ever notice that when you hear a history, that the history is written by who? The winners, right? So it's interesting to me is that this story of the crying out for a king and then the stories of Saul and David and Solomon are written by the winners. They tell a very specific perspective of what it was like to live as the wealthy elite of this time, because otherwise we wouldn't have this history at all. These are the folks who have the capability of writing and recording this history, right? So I wonder, Do you think the common people would have wanted a king? Just a wonder. Do you think moving from this very tribal culture, this is very different from the way that we imagine things, do you think the people would have wanted to be united by a king? And we don't know. You think so? Mary, yeah. That's right. So the prophet Samuel was one who spoke out to bring the people together for safety, for security, for the people. So the tribes united, and the king is in place. And then Solomon picks up the reins after his father, and Solomon built the temple. But he also did a number of other things. We often think of this as being a very good idea. He built the temple. There was a place for worship for God. He consolidated the land. He built an amazing administration. And he expanded the kingdom of Israel. So when you read in the book 1 Kings in the Bible, it tells this story where Solomon's empire was boasting about its successes. And in the accounts that are given in the Bible, it compares the Israelite kingdom to other kingdoms of its day, like the Egyptians. Solomon is being compared to other rulers in his efficiency, his greed, his power, his wealth, and his wisdom. So it doesn't take long in Israel for the power structure and the system that is in place with an Israelite king to begin to look exactly like the systems that were in place when the people were living in Egypt. Let's explore this together. Let's read about the affluence of Solomon's empire first. This is in 1 Kings chapter 4. Let's read this together. Judah and Israel were densely populated, like sand on an ocean beach. All their needs were met. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon was sovereign over all the kingdoms from the river Euphrates in the east to the country of the Philistines in the west, all the way to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and were vassals of Solomon all of his life. One day's food supply for Solomon's household was 185 bushels of fine flour, 375 bushels of meal, 10 grain-fed cattle, 20 range cattle, 100 sheep, and miscellaneous deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. So it's becoming evident that Solomon's reign is following in the footsteps of other rulers in the region, and that he is accumulating these massive amounts of wealth. And he's accumulating this wealth through a very intentional and widespread administrative taxation system. So this begs the question, how much is enough? How much is enough when there are others who do not have enough? And how do we see through these systems to see those people who do not have enough? Yeah, sure.
If I recall correctly, God did not want them to have any, but he wanted to have them. Or was that Samuel that?
There's
so something wanted to say, didn't think it was a good idea, but wanted to end it.
Yeah, that's what happens. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So, wealth, this wealth that is being accumulated by Solomon's leadership, his empire. Power. Solomon is also consolidating power. So let's read together from 1 Kings chapter 5. King Solomon raised a workforce of 30,000 men from all over Israel. He sent them in shifts of 10,000 each month to the Lebanon forest. They would work a month in Lebanon, and then be at home 2 months. Adoniram was in charge of the workers. Solomon had 70,000 unskilled workers and another 80,000 stonecutters up in the hills, plus 3,300 foremen managing the project and supervising the work crews. Following the king's orders, he tossed the best stone, dressed stone for the foundation of the temple. Solomon and Aaron's construction workers, assisted by the men of Gebal, cut and prepared the timber and stone for building the temple. So you see, it didn't take long for Solomon to begin conscripting outside foreign labor and enslaving them into a forced system of work to build his temple. The groups of slaves from foreign rivals would pay the price of his empire building, and most of the unskilled laborers were forced into work. All of these laborers were conscripted from the northern regions of Israel, and they were forced into their jobs. Sound familiar? Sound like the story of the Pharaoh in Egypt? So this begs a few questions, and I'm going to do this on two different levels. First is a personal level. How do I use my power and influence? Something for each of us to reflect on. How do I consider in my world, as I make my way through the world, in the people I interact with, how do I consider the price others have to pay for my projects? How do I use the power and the privilege that I have in my relationships with others? And do I take a step back when I am in the person with the privilege in the conversation? How do I take a step back and allow someone else's voice to be heard and share power? Thinking about this on a societal level, this begs the question about partisan politics and who is leading and guiding our conversations about how we are living. When I say politics, I mean how we are governing and working and living together in community. Do we come together in governance for the benefit of the whole and the well-being of all? And how do we move beyond labels and characterizations and all of the things that we stereotype people who think differently from us so that we can see through the systems of power so that we can be lifting up all voices in the conversation about how we live together in community? How do we use power so that all people have a voice in the conversation? Now, religion. Because Solomon didn't only use his power to enslave people, to build a temple, to accumulate wealth. He also used religion as a part of this system. So let's read together from 1 Kings chapter 8. Then Solomon spoke, "God has told us that he lives in the dark where no one can see him. I built this splendid temple, O God, to mark your invisible presence forever." Solomon built the temple to be the visible presence of the invisible God, and it is elaborate, it is ornate, it is massive. If you've ever been to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, it is a massive space. It is also a sign by the people who are in power that God is on their side. So this is a sign that God's reign is backing the reign of Solomon, and it is the establishment of the divine enthroning of Solomon. The temple becomes the place where the authority of God is proclaimed, and religion is used to show the collusion between God and empire. There is a sacrificial system that is in place, a religious system that is in place, in order to keep insiders and outsiders separated from each other. In this system, the comfort of the wealthy can be proclaimed as religious inspiration. Poverty can be seen as a need for repentance. The temple system of sacrifice is dangerous. It is manipulative, and it becomes controlling, and it is in direct opposition of the mission of God that Moses had for the people in the wilderness. What was the law that Moses received when the community was in the wilderness? It was about the Ten Commandments. It was about how people are in relationship with God and in relationship with each other. And instead, in the temple system of sacrifice, it's about money and wealth, what people can afford to sacrifice in this temple system. So religion becomes this way of subduing the masses. It's a dangerous system. And religion can become so incredibly manipulative and an abuse of power in such systems. So how do we create communities of faith that are built on God's dream for community? And how can we understand the spiritual life about more than feeling good about ourselves? I mean, yes, we come and we worship each week because we want to feel and we need the comfort and the security of the love and the grace and the mercy of God. But is that all we need? Is God sometimes calling us to uncomfortable places to hear the voices of people who are suffering? And how can we be honest about how we carefully use spirituality so that it is based in courage, that it is not afraid of feeling the pain and the suffering of others? Solomon's kingship really becomes the antithesis of God's vision of community. Now, this doesn't happen overnight, but the people are motivated by greed, by power. I mean, we're human beings, right? I mean, I have to admit that there are times in my life when I can be motivated by greed and power, and I have to remind myself to be again in relationship with God and with others, and I can take a hard look at myself. It doesn't take long for God's vision for humanity to become again broken. So let's look at our honest culture, our own culture, and take an honest look at our own context to see, have we succumbed to this? Is this alive in our community? And I would argue that it is. In a system of privilege, it is often hard to see. But if we can break through these systems, we can begin to understand a little bit about what privilege is and how, if we gain a conscious awareness of these systems of privilege, that we can come back and return to God's hope for us to seek justice together. So privilege. What is privilege? What do we mean when we say privilege? It's power. Is it power earned? No. This is what makes the conversation around privilege hard. Privilege is something that you are born into. You don't earn privilege. It's something that society as a whole deems, right? So this isn't anything that one, like I can't look at one person and say, blame them or scapegoat them that this system exists. I mean, this is something that our society over many, many years has built into our cultural context. So privilege is something that you're born into, it's not earned, and it's something that you may be given by society that others don't have. So how do we understand what those systems of privilege are? So first is race. Being born into a different ethnicity and skin color changes your advantages and access to employment and educational opportunities. It's impossible to deny that being born with white skin in America affords people certain unearned privileges in life that people of other skin colors simply are not afforded. For example, can you turn on the television and see people of your race and ethnicity, or can you open up a newspaper and see people of your race widely represented? Or when you're told about our collective national heritage, are you shown or told of the experience of people of your race and ethnicity? Or if a traffic cop pulls you over or the IRS audits your tax return, can you be sure that you haven't been singled out based on your race or ethnicity? Citizenship. Most of us take citizenship for granted, but it is also a privilege that we're born into in this country that can afford us certain privileges over non-citizens that they will never be able to access. For example, this week, a friend of mine who is a pastor in New York City, she works with an organization in New York City to assist immigrants through the immigration process. Her coworker, who has been a legal citizen in this country for 20 years and has legal immigrant status but is not a citizen, was detained and arrested on Tuesday because he was offering protection to other immigrants. And why was that allowed to happen? Simply because he is not a citizen. Your class. Being born into a family that is stable can help guarantee your health, your happiness, your safety, your education, your intelligence, and your future opportunities. Economics, property values, the home you're able to purchase, where you are able to live gives you access to many opportunities and the ability to secure your quality of life. Sexual orientation. Many people aren't aware, but in the state of Pennsylvania, if you are not straight, you can be discriminated against in terms of employment, housing, and many other opportunities. Sex. Sex is if you're born male or female. So if you're born male, you can assume that you can walk through a parking garage without worrying that you'll be raped or then have to deal with a defense attorney who's going to blame it on what you were wearing if you were raped. It's just a privilege that is afforded to you if you're a man. Ability. Here's another thing that many of us take for granted. If I am able-bodied, there are certain privileges that are afforded to me. So for example, a friend of mine, her son, is in a wheelchair. And so before she even leaves the house, she has to think through every single step to get to the store, to get what she needs, and to be able to think, can I make it, or what barriers will hold me up that I cannot enter into a space? Or your gender identity is another piece of privilege. Have you heard the word cisgender? Cisgender means that your sex and your gender identity match. So I am a woman and I identify as feminine. They match. A friend of mine who is a woman who identifies as masculine. Often if we're out at a restaurant or we're going somewhere together, she gets called sir all the time. All the time. Hello, sir. Like, she looks like a man. But she is a woman. She shared a story with me one time that she is absolutely terrified of walking into a public restroom because most people don't know she's a woman. She's how she identifies. It's a privilege that I have often taken for granted. So how do we see beyond this system of privilege to come together, to figure out how we can see beyond these systems that some privileges are afforded to others? How do we see beyond the system so that we can begin to have a raised consciousness of how God is desiring for us to live together in community? And I think that the key to seeing beyond these systems is really based in empathy. Because I don't think blame helps us in these conversations. And yes, there are people who are afforded more privilege than others. But when we raise our consciousness that we have a level of privilege that others are not afforded. What it enables us to do is engage in conversation in such a way that we can begin to hear the stories of others and identify with their pain and suffering so that we can begin to build relationships with one another that are genuine, that are honest, and that are life-giving. It is from this place that we're able to build authentic, meaningful, personal relationships and create communities that have a moral center that is not rooted in the values of affluence, power, and religion. Breaking through these systems requires us to do some really hard work and to feel the pain of others who are suffering within the system. But when we break through and we have this raised consciousness, we can have the courage to be vulnerable in these conversations, to allow someone else to have a voice or to speak up when we see someone who is being taken advantage of. It's about using the power that we or privilege that we have to build relationships. And I think more than ever that it was Martin Luther King who was the first modern day prophet who encouraged us to see God's vision for us and who had the prophetic imagination to have a dream and to talk about God's dream for us that was beyond those systems of power and who brought people together. In this country, there are systems in place which allow for the prosperity of some at the expense of a few. And I'd like to just go back very quickly to his letter from a Birmingham jail, because I think it was in this letter when King wrote to his fellow clergymen to try to explain to them the system that was in place, Jim Crow, and these systems of separation that were meant to divide people, to keep them in their place at the expense of others who were feeling comfortable. But this is what Dr. King wrote. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what has happened to the American Negro. The United States Negro is moving with a sense of urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. If one recognizes the vital urge that has engulfed the Negro community, one should readily understand why public demonstrations are taking place. So let's try to understand why we must do so. If his repressed emotions are not released in nonviolent ways, they will seek expression through violence, and this is not a threat, but a fact of history. So I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Rather, I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into the creative outlet of nonviolent action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies and bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice when he said, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream? And was not Paul an extremist for Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. And was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God, and John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? And perhaps the South, the nation, and the whole world are in dire need of creative extremists. I think we are indeed in need again, for creative extremists. who can see beyond these systems of power in our nation, in our communities, and who are willing to step out in God's Spirit to speak the truth in love, and to have courage to love those who are the most vulnerable, and who are willing to open up a conversation to include all of God's children. I can say so much more about justice and about love. But sometimes I forget that it is in a simple way that we can show love and justice, simply by being together. And I am reminded that at this table, Jesus welcomes all people. All people. All people are worthy of dignity and love. All people are called to have a voice for love. When we come to this table, the amazing thing is that all of those systems of privilege just disappear. And we all come as we are, caring who we are, opening our hearts to God, and saying, God, I need you, and I need community, and I need your love, I need your mercy for one more day. We are all invited to participate and to share in this table where all people are valued and loved. This is God's dream for us, where one day all people, white people and black people, straight people and gay people, male and female, can come together as one, living God's dream for us. And so we remember that night when Jesus gathered his disciples together for the Passover feast. The Passover feast when he shared and remembered and told the story of when the Israelites moved from slavery into freedom. He remembered that story as he took the bread. And he gave God thanks, and he broke the bread and gave it to his disciples, and he said, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, during the supper, he took the cup, and he gave God thanks, and he blessed the cup, and he said, this is the cup of the new covenant in my blood, poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins, and as often as you drink this, do this in remembrance of me. So when we eat this bread and we drink this cup, we come together as the children of God, living the dream for a community where justice and peace and mercy and love and forgiveness can become real to us each and every day. These are the gifts of God for the people of God. So come, for all things are now ready.